Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we'll explore the Good Food Revolution, a movement dedicated to equitable and sustainable food and creating a just world, one food secure community at a time. Then on the Scholar Circle, the economic crises are pushing more people into homelessness, an already pervasive epidemic in America. Why are so many people without homes, and what can be done about it? America's farm program has some fundamental flaws, according to reports from the Environmental Working Group. They've been subsidizing landowners rather than farmers or those who are most in need. They also tend to support farming practices that don't promote either the healthiest food or sustainability. But some smaller movements are emerging to change the practices, some in very unlikely places. We're joined now by Will Allen. He is the author of The Good Food Revolution. He's also the founder of Growing Power, a nonprofit dedicated to equitable and sustainable food. And he says, creating a just world, one food secure community at a time. Welcome, Will Allen. It's great to have you here with us in studio.
It's great to be here, Maria.
What I'd like to start with is how your own family history took you back to the farm.
Both my parents from South Carolina, and they were both involved in agriculture. My mother's family, as far back as 400 years, they were both sharecroppers. And, of course, that wasn't a very good profession. My father escaped, left sharecropping, and migrated during the Great Migration to the Washington, D.C. area back in the 30s. And then my mother, who was actually married to another person, migrated to Maryland also. So when my parents remarried, and myself and my brothers, we grew up growing our own food. About 95% of the food that we ate, we grew ourselves. I learned those skills at a very, very early age, kind of how to take care of yourself by being proactive and bringing your own food into your life, you know, which is much different than the kids today.
You actually talked about in your book the Great Migration and how it affected specifically African Americans in their own, for lack of a better word, empowerment.
One of the things that we see started to play out during that period of time is many of the skills about how to grow food pretty much stopped. It wasn't passed on. And farming is something that you pass on to the next generation. So that was something that really affected people's lives. And now we're starting to see the results of that in terms of the diseases, diabetes, high blood pressure, lack of a good food system, lack of access to food in communities today, and many young people not really knowing where their food came from, and their parents missed out. A couple generations really missed out on getting those skills. And those are life skills passed on to them.
The other thing you wrote about is relationship to the earth, that sense of self-dignity, being able to grow your own food.
Yeah, it's something that, again, wasn't passed on, and we're all kind of people of the earth, whether we want to admit it or not. You know, I think a lot of people have lost connection because back in the day, everybody had a family member, very close family member, that was involved in agriculture and growing food. So we've gotten away from that into this kind of centralized food system, industrial food system, where our food is coming from just a few places around the country. And matter of fact, only 1% of food in Milwaukee and most major cities like Detroit and Youngstown, Ohio, Buffalo, New York, less than 1% is locally grown today. But back in the 30s and 40s, a lot of the food that we ate was grown within those states. So we at least had regional food systems, but today we don't have that. So the work that we've been doing over these past years is really to resurrect that system. Everybody thinks of it as a new food system, but it's really about resurrecting a system that we already had, but doing it in a different kind of way and doing it with different people, not necessarily folks that grew up on farms, but young people that are in our colleges and in universities and our high schools and in programs, youth serving programs at nonprofits around the country.
I found it interesting, the juxtaposition of first your own family history, then becoming a professional ball player, then working in corporate America, but in the food industry, and then coming to this sort of homecoming back to the earth, back to the farm, and using that to really affect in a positive way people's health, the environment, the communities.
Right.
Can you make that connection?
When I left Maryland to go away to college, I had about 100 scholarship offers, decided to go to University of Miami. at that point in time, I said, I'll never do this farming again, because I always had to be home early. We didn't have gas stoves and that sort of thing. We had wood stoves. I had to cut wood and that sort of thing. And my friends, I always thought my friends were having this great time out. I always had to be in early. As a matter of fact, my high school teammates used to tease me and call me in early, because my father was very strict, and I go play games and I'm the big star, but I had to be home. So I said, I want to have some fun, you know. So when I left to go to college, I said to myself, I never want to do this kind of work again. And I think many rural farm kids say that same thing. But after college, went over to Europe to play basketball, and one of my teammates' family had a farm. And he asked me if I wanted to go out one day and on the farm, and I went out and I helped them plant some potatoes. And they did it the way that we did. They didn't have any tractors or anything, so we spaded up ground and planted, and the soil was very rich, because Europeans are way ahead of us in terms of knowing about the soil and how important the soil is, and it's all about the soil, is something I always say. So that was the transformative moment. I also found myself, I would take my wife and the kids out in the country, and I think they thought I was crazy, just looking at cows and stuff, you know. And we'd park and kind of look at the cows and look at the land. And all of a sudden, a strong desire to grow food again. And I actually started doing it. I got 25 chickens, and we had a garden. And Belgium's a small country, so I knew most of the players on the other teams, Americans. There were two Americans on each team in our league. And during Thanksgiving and Christmas, we'd have them over to our house, and my wife, Cindy, would fix this wonderful meal with some of the vegetables that we grow, and have this big feast with all the American players and so forth. So here I was, back doing the same things that my parents did, and having people over at our house, because we were known as the people that had all the food. And my parents' friends and my teammates and stuff would kind of congregate at our house, because my mother loved to cook, and she would cook at any time. So she would cook enough food, I think, every meal for about 30 people. We were big people, you know, me being 6'7". And food was always a very important and powerful piece in our lives. And so now I'm doing pretty much the same thing, growing food, getting it to folks in all the communities around Milwaukee and Chicago and Madison.
So let's talk about how this developed. It seems to me that you looked at several different models, including like the community farming. And in some ways you found that to be really great, but in some ways you thought, well, poor people can't actually participate in that. Where did you go from?
Well, my whole thing has always been to be able to have everybody access the same good food, regardless of their economic situation. So I had to come up with some schemes to make that happen, in terms of having a more integrated food system to grow 150 or more crops, to be able to...
On a very small plot.
Well, yeah. I mean, I had lots of rural farming experience and some rural farms as well. But this idea of growing food in the city, close to where people live, and doing it in a way that you start looking at agriculture instead of acres or hectares, to look at it in terms of square footage. So that was part of the thing that we do, is to be able to grow food at $5 to $50 a square foot. At $5 a square foot, you're grossing about $200,000 an acre, because there's 43,000 something square feet in an acre. So if you look at it that way, and to be able to get that food in different ways to in different communities, regardless, because I didn't want our food just to go to wealthy people, this good food, natural food grown without chemicals. So I had to come up with ways of getting it to low-income people at a reasonable price. And to be able to do that, some of the things that we came up with was the use of renewable energy in a whole bunch of different ways to cut the production cost, because that's what dictates the cost of our food. I believe that a lot of our organic food is artificially inflated, because they're gearing that food for a particular audience. But if we're able to cut the production cost, to be able to grow our own soil, because you need new soil if you're going to grow in the city, because everything is contaminated. So we grow soil first. If you're not able to grow soil, you can't scale up to the point to be able to grow this healthy food. So cutting the production cost is really where it's at.
One of the philosophical parts that I alluded to in an earlier question about coming from the for-profit food industry and then moving into really a world of nonprofit natural food.
Right.
natural?
I think I was positioned because of my for-profit. I come from a for-profit perspective. I didn't know much about nonprofit organizations. But once I bought that farm in 1993, and our first couple of years, we were a for-profit entity. And I helped a youth group who needed some help in starting an organic garden. And I gave them some land. And we got an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And my friends said, since you like working with kids, you should start a nonprofit. And I said, I don't really know anything about nonprofit work. They came from the nonprofit arena, so they said, we'll be your first board and we'll do the administrative work, because I said, all I want to do is work with the kids and teach the kids about where their food came from and how to grow it and that sort of thing. Bringing what I had and the skill set that I had in terms of working for corporate companies really bodes well for us now, because you can't really sustain a nonprofit today without having some type of income other than writing grants or what I call begging for money. I think today you have to be kind of this social entrepreneurial organization to survive, because there are more nonprofits. It seems like everybody can become a nonprofit. It used to be tough to become a nonprofit, but they seem to give 501c3s out like candy. Many of them are scaling back because there's not a lot of money out there, because the funders, when the economy's bad, they don't have a lot of money to give out. So many nonprofits don't have that business skill set to survive the day, and I see a lot of them scaling down instead of scaling up. And we've been able to scale up because we have over 40 income streams coming into Growing Power. And we do write some grants, but we have a very small grant department, and much of our income comes from fee-for-service and selling food.
Reminds me just a little bit, Foods from the Hood.
Yeah, they've been around a long time, and they were bottling their different products and so forth. So they're pretty famous for doing that, with the kids getting scholarships to college and that.
Were you watching the South Central Farms when they were here in Los Angeles?
Yeah, I think everybody in the country was very upset when they lost those farms, because that was a great project too. And that's part of what this is all about. We're also a land trust to try to secure land for agriculture over a long period of time, to put land in trust or to be able to purchase land so you can do this farming act. I go out and try to build the relationships to be able to secure land over a long period of time. Now, we've been able to purchase some land. Our headquarters is owned by Growing Power now,
which is your nonprofit.
Yeah, that's a great start. And we have long-term leases with the Milwaukee Public School System and corporate companies and folks that really like our mission and vision to the future about growing local food.
Growing local food, and then also you're engaging the kids at the schools.
I've seen a change in terms of what's happening at the schools, because now we're training teachers to do hands-on learning. When educators go to college, they get a lot of practical education out in the community and so forth. So now what we're doing is helping to train some of those teachers in how to grow food and how to build aquaponic systems to teach the kids, to get the kids engaged, and how to teach these kids how to prepare the food, you know, to cook the food. We're really attacking it from every angle you can possibly attack it from through our nonprofit.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. We've been speaking with Will Allen. He's the author of The Good Food Revolution and the founder of Growing Power. Let's turn to the soil. You said you had to grow the soil because urban soil tends to have been destroyed by fertilizers and such. And you've talked about in your book a whole section about what that takes. Can you talk about this transition all the way to Growing Power that had impacts? One was the worm revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the actual Growing Power revolution.
Yeah. Well, when I grew up, we grew soil ourselves. We had chickens, so the waste from the chickens we'd compost, and that's what we'd use for fertilizer because we couldn't afford to buy commercial fertilizer. And at that time, coming out of the Second World War is when we started using all the commercial fertilizer and all the pesticides and herbicides and so forth. And that's continued, and that's what really fueled these large industrial farms, the use of chemicals and technology around GMO foods and that sort of thing. But folks today, these generations, we don't know very much about the food that we eat every day. And it's really important to know about the food you eat, and because most people don't know, it's all about the soil. If you're going to eat organic or natural foods, you have to grow new soil because our soil is contaminated. We've contaminated our soil, not only in urban areas, but in suburban areas with all the lawn spraying and all the chemicals we've used, and of course in the rural communities because of how industrial agriculture has gotten almost completely away from, on large farms, away from growing natural food and using GMO seeds and spraying with Roundup and that sort of thing. So it's so important to be able to grow new soil, and that's what we do, because healthy soil, you should have 30 worms in every square foot of soil. We wouldn't have to do anything to the soil if we had that condition, but we don't have that condition. So we have to manufacture new soil. And to do that, we take the waste that goes in a landfill, food waste and carbon waste, and we compost that and grow soil, and we use that to grow the food. So we don't have any digging equipment. When we grow in the city, we put 2 feet of new soil on top of the existing soil or on top of asphalt or concrete or rooftops, and we grow food in it. And that's what we have to do. We have to grow new soil. And that's one of the toughest things to do.
You can put that on asphalt?
Yes, we grow on asphalt and concrete. A lot of our farms. So when I go into cities and I look for places to grow, I don't necessarily look for green grass.
So you don't necessarily break up the concrete either?
No.
And get rid of it?
No, because below the concrete...
You just put the soil on top of it.
Right. Below the concrete may be a lot of contaminants. And we've had tissue samples of our crops, and we've never come up with any kind of contaminants being taken up when we use this soil. Now, the other important thing is that we incorporate worms. We have worm nurseries, large worm nurseries. We grow worms. We started with 30 pounds of worms. We have over 7,000 pounds of worms on one farm. And we inject worms into all of our compost. So it's living soil. And that's what a lot of people really need to do, is to be really grow in living soil. Those microorganisms tickle the root fibers, and that's what makes food grow, and that's what makes food taste good. Because it's all about the soil. If you have healthy soil, the food tastes so much different than when you don't have the right micronutrients in the soil.
Which then, of course, contributes to having healthy people.
Right. Because much of the food that's shipped from, say, and I don't want to pick on, because I'm out here in California, pick on the California, but when food is shipped from California, from Salinas into Milwaukee or New York, it takes about 3 days. It may stay out here in the warehouses a couple of days. Now you're talking about 5 days, and it goes to the wholesalers. It may stay a couple more days, and then the grocery stores put it on the shelf, and we go in and buy it. And when you go in the grocery store today, they do such a great job with all the lights, you know, the different colored lights and the misters and everything. But nobody in that store is going to tell you how old that food is, unless you buy something like strawberries and they have a date on it or something like that. But most of the vegetables, you have no idea how old they are. So a lot of times we're eating food that's 8 or 9 days old, and it's lost 50% of its nutrients in half cellulose. Regardless of whether we buy it at a very high-end store, it's the same thing. It doesn't matter whether it's at a high-end store or you buy it from some lower-end store. It still travels those miles, and it's lost a lot of its impact. Best case scenario is to grow it in your backyard or side yard and eat it the same day. You pick it and you eat it the same day.
If you can beat the squirrels.
Well, there's ways of getting around that, too.
Yeah, do tell.
There are ways of getting around the animals and the pests and so forth. But it's really important, a local food system, to get that food in our bellies within a day, day and a half of production versus 8, 9, 10 days. So it used to be that way, and we need to go back to those days. Realistically, we're not going to get all of our food from a local food system, but we should be able to walk into a grocery store, walk in and look at the produce aisle and have a locally grown section. And not have to search, because today you really have to search for locally grown labels and stores, and, you know, you get frustrated.
If you were to imagine your vision of what you ultimately would like to see done and the impact that you'd like to have on youth, on communities, on health, on the environment, how would you articulate the vision and the impact?
The vision piece, we're a long way from really getting there. We have to quantify a lot of things because a lot of people have a tremendous amount of excitement. That's why it's gone from a movement to a revolution. Every city I go to, large crowds. Of course, Michael Pollan has written so much about it, and Eric Schlosser, and many other books, and there's so many documentaries. So the excitement's there, but we have to quantify so many things. We have to quantify that you can actually cash flow these small farms in cities. We have to quantify things like aquaculture, taking these vacant buildings and doing fish systems, because 50% of our fish is farm grown. It's going to go to 75%. So it's tremendous opportunity for folks to be able to grow fish as a protein source. But we have to quantify and figure out the types of systems that they need to grow these fish in and how to grow the fish and be able to train people, because this kind of agriculture is about square footage and being able to use every bit of space, because this is high-valued space inside cities, inside greenhouses. So there's so much work to be done. What we're trying to do at Growing Power is to quantify that you can change the dynamics. I believe in the next several years we'll go from 1% to 10% in local food production. That's just our organization doing that. So if we can get other organizations to chime in, we can get a larger percentage of locally grown food. Because right now, if everybody said they wanted to eat healthy food, we don't have enough in this city or any other city to really eat healthy food grown without chemicals. So we need to scale that up. The talk is great, but we really need to get to work. The exciting part is we have all these young people, over 75% are under 40 now, that want to do this. And we have older people that are leaving professions, even doctors and lawyers, that come to our trainings every month. They want to leave the profession. And we have more people of color since the First Lady put the garden on the White House lawn. They said 10 million new people started growing food, many of them people of color who 15 years ago would tell me, Will, why are you doing this work? It's slaves' work. I don't hear that anymore. So we've seen that transformation take place. The folks that grew food under duress and slavery and sharecropping want to go back to growing food again, because they've been educated and their health has gone south, and obesity rates are at an all-time high. Our country is at its all-time low point in terms of our health. We need to do this to survive.
You were talking about, you know, getting people out there to actually do this and affect the change, and it reminded me of a section in your book where you talked about a do tank instead of a think tank.
We can sit around a table and plan. And I'm not against planning, because we do project planning. But we do project planning to launch people into action. Because, like I said, we can sit around a table for 2 or 3 years. We can get planning grants. I used to get really pissed off because I'd see these organizations get these planning grants, and they would sit around for 2, 3 years and talk about doing something. And once the grant was over, everybody scattered to the hills and nothing got done. Meanwhile, we're struggling for dollars just to get some land or tools or whatever. And we were just doing stuff, you know. It might have not been perfect, because you can never, I think a lot of times when we plan things, we're waiting for that perfect moment to get started. There is never a perfect moment. So my thing is, let's get started. Let's learn, because farming is something you learn not in a classroom, but in a hands-on way. Let's go out and learn how to deal with these conditions that we're dealt with in the cities or wherever, and tweak it along the way. But let's go out and do something.
Finally, in terms of policies that would be supportive of this kind of food, farming, earth, environment, community, have you started to see those come into existence?
Absolutely. Recently, I was in Boston. The mayor of Boston and the zoning department invited me in to launch their effort to change policy on growing food in the city of Boston, because they had no policy. So in some ways, it was illegal, even though there were groups growing, youth groups like the Food Project in Boston and others that were growing food, but it was really illegal. And they wanted to come up with some policies. And this was really being pushed by the city, which was highly unusual, because it's usually pushed by community groups. As a matter of fact, a couple of community groups that were pushing back, saying, why is the city wanting to create a policy? They thought it was some sinister move by the city. But in fact, the mayor of Boston and the zoning department was seeing what was happening around the country in other cities like Milwaukee. They didn't want to be left behind. They wanted agricultural zoning in all three areas, residential, industrial, and commercial, like we have in Milwaukee. So I've seen that change. But the reason that that has changed is because of concrete projects, not because folks have gone to City Hall and lobbied and so forth, stood in a line, or gone to D.C. and stood in a line and tried to lobby for that. I think what we've done in Milwaukee is have this concrete project that we can bring policymakers out and show them that this is something that'll benefit the city, that this becomes an asset to the city. And the fact that we brought in a national conference every year for the last 7 years to the tune of about $15 million to the city. And those are their numbers to the city of Milwaukee. Then you start being looked at as an asset. So you get the mayor, you get the city council, you get everybody on board, and they want to see urban agriculture grow because they look at it as an asset. In the local community, it has to start with the local community. As the first thing we did was to engage the local community, so we have them on board at the very beginning many years ago.
Well, thank you so much, Will Allen. Again, the book is called The Good Food Revolution, Growing Healthy Food, People, and Communities. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maria.
When we come back, why are so many people without homes, and what can be done about it? Next up on the Scholar Circle, stay tuned.
Homeless, homeless. Moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake. Homeless, we homeless. We moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake.
And we are
homeless.
We are
homeless. We moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake. And we are homeless.
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 Boom, boom.
Moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake.
Yes, you are.
Yes, you are.
Yes, you are.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. By some counts, an estimated 2.3 to 3.5 million people experience homelessness in America in a given year. Why are so many people without homes? What are the realities for the homeless? How are the very poor faring? And what can be done about it? We're joined by three experts. Samson Barris is a professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University and the founder and executive director of Pathway to Housing. Among his publications are Housing First, the Pathways Model to End Homelessness for People with a Mental Illness and Addiction Manual. James Bumall is professor of the Bryn Mawr College, Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research. His publications include Homeless in America and Down and Out in Berkeley, an overview of a study of street people. Kim Hopper is a medical anthropologist and research scientist at the Nathan S. Klein Institute for Psychiatric Research, where he co-directs the Center for the Study of Issues in Public Mental Health. His publications include Reckoning with Homelessness. He's also co-editor of the forthcoming Recovery from Schizophrenia, an International Perspective. Thank you so much for being with us. Can we get a sense of what the realities are with regards to homelessness and the trends that are occurring? Jim Bumall.
I can't tell you how many of what type and where they are, and I think, frankly, that anybody who says they can is fudging. There are just so many problems with how we define homelessness and how we count who's homeless that the numbers really don't make that much of a difference. What we know is that there are a lot of people in shelters, and there are a lot of people who are doubled up with friends, families, sleeping in all kinds of places that human beings weren't meant to sleep. And that's getting worse. From what I understand, family homelessness, by which I mean one or more adults with kids in tow, is the single fastest growing group among homeless people. And given the nature of our economy and the nature of our public assistance system, that's hardly a surprise.
Kim Hopper?
The most interesting attempt ever to estimate the overall numbers of people who have been in and out of homelessness over a particular period of time was done by some researchers at Columbia in the 90s. They had asked people about their attitudes towards homeless people, and they wondered whether having been homeless yourself might affect those attitudes. So they added a tiny little question about your own history as homeless, and they discovered that about 3% of their respondents had been homeless during the last 5 years of the 1980s, which was a huge number, much larger than anybody had been talking about at the time. But it sort of alerted us to the fact that much of this is invisible, much of it is evanescent, some of it is episodic, and the part we see tends to be chronic, sort of in your face or on somebody's shelter roster?
This is Jim Baumol. I think the most important thing for people to understand in a general sense is that we've returned to the period that extended from basically the 1870s until the end of the Great Depression, when being homeless was a really common experience of working class families for some usually short period of time. And I think the figures that researchers at Penn came up with a few years ago in looking at the shelter systems in both New York and Philadelphia was that some phenomenal figure, like 9% of all African American children, spend some time homeless.
That is quite remarkable.
That's stunning.
Samson Barris?
I sort of think of this in two ways. From what Jim is saying, historically, since the 1980s in this country, since the Reagan administration, the income disparity in the United States has gone from 0.30 to 0.47, meaning that the difference between rich and poor is growing every year. Now, why that's important, as the Occupy Wall Street people pointed out across the country, is that that kind of income disparity is correlated to social problems, homelessness being among them. So that we have, since the 1980s, this steady increase in the number of people homeless, and Jim and Kim both point out that families are the fastest growing number. Most painful in that story is the fact that in the New York City shelter system, where about 28,000 families, which is 90% women with children, show up, the reason that they end up homeless, the primary reason they get for being homeless, is that their child got sick. So the child gets sick, either you take off work, you lose your job because you're taking care of your kid, or you have to pay the doctor's bill and you can't pay the rent, and you end up in the shelter system. So that the homelessness is just sort of the tip of an iceberg of income disparity, no national health plan, no living wage. You know, it's just sort of the what we see above the surface of structural problems that are generating more and more homeless people, and we're not really even talking about the foundational problems that keep contributing to this homelessness issue.
So you said since the 1980s, but as I understand, this is a phenomenon that really did go farther back, just didn't accelerate as much since the 1980s. What are the structural or policy or other factors that are driving this?
This is Jim Baumol. We could talk about nuances. There are lots of rivulets that feed the larger stream. But the basic issue of homelessness, regardless of someone's mental health, their history of addiction, is the mismatch between income and the cost of housing. That's the bottom line, so to speak. Homeless people don't fall out of the middle class, by and large. They fall out of normal poverty. Homelessness is becoming part of normal poverty. And they can't earn a wage that will pay for housing. And those jobs are not coming back unless we create them. And that's not what we're talking about in terms of public policy today. I think the real scary thing, as Sam mentioned, about income disparities, is that nobody's talking about how we're going to react to a huge oversupply of unskilled labor in all of the major cities in the United States, except maybe a place like San Francisco, and that's a little peculiar. God knows what it's going to look like in 10 years. And so we've narrowed our focus and we've cheapened our goals by talking about, we won't solve homelessness this millennium. We'll solve chronic homelessness. And then we define chronic homelessness really to be a problem of people with very serious psychiatric or physical impairments who have been homeless for a long time, because we've got a benefit system that at least supports them at a very, very modest level.
You've mentioned the issue of mental illness, and I understand there is quite a large percentage. I think, Jim Baumol, I saw in one of your older papers, something like 22% of homeless dealt with some kind of mental illness.
It depends where you count them and how you ask them about mental illness. Yeah, there's a significant portion of homeless people, if we're talking about people in shelters, who have a reasonably recent history of serious mental illness. But the thing to keep in mind is that the vast majority of people with serious mental illnesses are not homeless. So to characterize the problem that way is to misread the connection between material well-being and the ability to stay in a home and symptoms of mental disorder. I think Sam can probably speak very directly to this because this is really his bread and butter.
Samson Barris, let's bring you back.
There is certainly a relationship between homelessness and mental illness in the same way that there's a relationship between homelessness and anybody else. So when you're homeless, you're going to get a lot worse. But the relationship between homeless and mental illness is not a psychiatric or mental health relationship. It's an economic relationship, primarily, because people who have a severe psychiatric disability are on Social Security or disability income, which is among the lowest incomes. I mean, welfare is even lower than that. But currently, people are getting something like $700 a month for their entire expenses. That includes lodging and food and medicine if they're taking it and so on. So that the people who are most at risk are the poorest of people, and among the poorest are people on fixed income. So when simple things happen, like their lease is renewed and the rent goes up by 3% or 5%, that is a risk factor for bringing them into homelessness. It's the appearance of so many people among the homeless, definitely overrepresented. People with severe mental illness is not so much that they are because of their psychosis rendered homeless, it's because they're too poor to stay housed.
Kim Hopper.
Well, or that they become sort of less eligible or less desirable as potential rental tenants. And there's a really interesting lesson in there. For the past 30 years, most of the time, having a mental illness was two strikes against you as far as getting out of homelessness. And then people like Samson Barris came along, and they showed that with proper supports and the money to make the rent on a regular basis, those folks could live decent, stable, non-homeless lives on their own. And all of a sudden, homelessness went from being a risk factor for staying in the shelter to a handicap for getting out of the shelter. So it really makes the point both Jim and Sam have been making, that mental illness only serves as a tipping factor, one way or the other, in a given context. Most of the time, it makes you less competitive in a housing market. But when programs are designed that specifically target these populations, it can actually give you a leg up on exiting homelessness.
Let's talk for a bit about society and how our society responds to this issue. Here in Los Angeles, we've seen homeless people be essentially pushed off into one corner so people won't see them. It seems like the trend is that the numbers are getting bigger and might even get larger given what's happening with foreclosures and such. How do we understand society's response related to the problem itself? Kim Hopper, isn't this your area?
Part of my area. I mean, it's supposed to be my area as an anthropologist, but I think there are probably two parts to that. One is that I think, in part, a great deal of accommodating activity goes on sort of backstage. And so the part of society's response that we don't see are all those people who are doubling up with friends and family, often on extremely long periods of time, that attest to a kind of moral economy of helping one another out, that very rarely gets any credit. But if it weren't there, the burden on public shelter facilities would be astronomical. It would just be completely insupportable. On the other hand, in the public spaces, there's pretty much an unwritten law that, for the most part, at least from the 1970s on, the idea of an overt spectacle of pain being part of the urban landscape has been really not the best way of advertising your city. So rendering people invisible, either through shelters or through the destruction of shanty towns or through just buying people a bus ticket someplace else, has been a very common practice. But that's, I think, only the tip of a much larger story about how ordinary folks are helping each other out so that the public relief system can actually work.
You know, I think if people in your audience want to ask themselves, well, how close am I to this, or how close is someone I love to this, the Census Bureau, I haven't seen the specific data, but I know roughly what they're going to be. Since 1960, the Census Bureau has been asking people if they have an adult between 18 and 35, related adult living in their household. That number's been going up every year since every census since 1960, and the 2010 census will have the highest figures ever, and they will be much higher than they were in 2000. And that testifies to the absorptive capacity of families to take their kids back in. You know, it's kind of a standing joke now with the boomerang kids. But a lot of that is that the cost of establishing an independent household is so extraordinary today that the people avoid homelessness, young people, by going home. Now, if you've grown up in foster care and you are what amounts to a social orphan, or if your family can't take you in, they don't have the room, they don't have the extra resources, you're out of luck. And this, again, is distinctly related to economic class origin, so that there's an awful lot of homelessness being essentially prevented in the middle class and higher regions by parents who can afford to take their kids back. And if it weren't for that, as Kim points out, we would be swimming in. You couldn't walk out your front door in the morning without somebody sleeping on your lawn.
The estimates for that period of young people in their 20s, in just about 10 years, it's gone from about one-third of them at some point having to return home, or what counts for home, to about a half of them in the last attempt to estimate this about a year or two ago. So it's, as Jim is saying, it's going up and getting harder to make it through that critical transitional decade without some help on the home front.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking about homelessness in America with James Bumall, professor of the Bryn Mawr College Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research, Samson Barris, professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University and the founder and executive director of Pathway to Housing, Kim Hopper, a medical anthropologist and research scientist at the Nathan S. Klein Institute for Psychiatric Research, where he co-directs the Center for the Study of Issues in Public Mental Health. Given the pervasiveness of this and the trends which seem to be moving upward, how do we explain a reasonable representative democracy dealing with it in the way that it is dealing with it today? Jim Bumall, I overheard you criticizing the Republicans.
Surprise.
I would be equally critical in many respects to the Democrats, by the way. It's trite to say that it's just not a priority. But in many respects, that's the case. And to the extent that we associate homelessness with public disorder, addiction, with mental illness, and we don't appreciate the logic that Sam discussed so well, we mistake an economic problem for something else. And in that respect, I think the media have failed us and failed homeless people in some ways. In that, and quite honestly, my colleagues in academe have largely been bought off by technical studies and interest in technical small fixes for program interventions. And while I wouldn't argue that that isn't necessary, we know how to rehouse people, and it simply requires the political will to do so, and that requires a movement behind it that has flagged badly in the last 10 or 15 years, I'm afraid.
This is Sam. I agree with this last piece. I agree with all of it, but the last piece in particular, I think that we have a fundamental issue in terms of what is our social covenant and who are we? You know, are we no longer welcoming the tired and the poor among us? And there, we have created a language and even a science and programming around homeless people that is a practice of separation. These are homeless, these are families, these are mentally ill. You know, different disciplines study them, different people treat them, but every one of those labels and diagnostic categories creates yet another level of separation where it's them and what are we going to do about them. And so that sort of as a society sort of defends us from seeing the problem as us. And, you know, the image that comes to mind for me is what happens when someone is housed. There was one particular woman who had been homeless in D.C., and she was showing us around her neighborhood because where she wanted to be rehoused was in the neighborhood where she had been homeless. It was familiar to her. She'd been there for years. And she's walking around the same blocks, and she's introducing us to people. And she says, oh, here's the church, she says, where I used to sleep outside. And the reason I go now on Sundays to this minister's church is because when I was homeless, he didn't push me away. And then she takes us over to the bodega, and the grocer, you know, she opens the door, says hello. The guy says hello back very warmly. And she turns and says, you know, he used to chase me out. When I was homeless, I would go in there. I would steal stuff. He called the police on me. Now I shop there all the time. We're like the best of friends. Same thing for the hair cutting place. And person after person in that community happy to see her enjoying her success. And I think if we could somehow, and I'm just using that image metaphorically, if we could understand that the solution to homelessness is essential for all of us, for all of our societal well-being, it'll be a healing at a much larger level. I think that has to be the starting point where that becomes important enough then to take it on as a real issue of a cohesive social contract as opposed to fixing and addressing it as a separate issue.
Well, that actually brings up a couple of things. One is, what are the costs to society to maintain this us and them system where we look away from our fellow brothers and sisters and neighbors and such? What are the costs to society, both, say, psychosocially and economically?
I'll tell you just from, this is Sam, it does not go unnoticed when you walk past a person who's homeless and you don't look at them. They feel the pain of that rejection. And people are very articulate about it when, you know, after you get to know people on the street and how that makes them feel, and the level of pain and anger associated with those feelings. I think that on the other end, on the passers-by end, I think there is a sort of a psychological shutting down, that you have to sort of see someone hurting that much and be able to walk past them is a cost on a spiritual level, if nothing else, of shutting yourself down empathically to be able to tolerate that. I think it's, you know, the cost of that on an emotional level is one thing. But there's also an actual cost we haven't talked about at all. The cost of homelessness is not insignificant. There's lots of good research that talks about police surveillance activity, in and out of jail, detox, emergency rooms, the institutional circuit, as Kim calls it, of people going in and out of these acute care services with great frequency and still ending up back on the street is an enormous taxpayer cost without a real solution, and a burden to the providers of those acute care services, and completely ineffective. And I mean, just yells speaks so loudly for the need for a permanent housing solution.
Kim Hopper?
I mean, one of the most remarkable research findings that I recall from the 90s is some very close work that Dennis Culhane and his colleagues did on programs like the one that Sam Sembaris runs in New York City. And they compared what it cost to let people essentially fend for themselves on the street with all those additional services that Sam just articulated with respect to police and ambulances and emergency rooms and detox facilities and occasional use of emergency shelters versus a completely predictable, regular, stabilized life in supported housing. And the costs between the two of them were essentially a wash at about $41,000 a year. So it costs the city of New York $41,000 for somebody who's essentially on their own on the street. And it costs about the same to house them with dignity, regularity, and security. So that's one anomaly. I think the other part that nobody wants to talk about is that one of the reasons we treat people so badly when they become desperately poor actually has sort of two parts to it. One is, this is a kind of social death, and like regular death, it's really hard to be close to because you see yourself reflected in that predicament. And I think particularly in times of sort of increasing economic distress, people have a hard time facing up to the fact that this extreme version of dispossession is something that may be not too alien or distant in their own future. And the second part of that is, by keeping the conditions of people who are actually sheltered in fairly wretched circumstances, with the, you know, the courts doing the best they can, legal aid lawyers building protections where they can find purchase, by keeping it a sort of shameful, wretched way of life, you bolster the motivation of all those people who are doubling up to stay out of the public system and sort of indirectly deter people from using a resource they could really benefit from if it worked well, and instead stay with friends and family.
If I may, I think maybe the most telling question with respect to the points that Kim has raised, that the question that I ask my kids, for example, is, can you stand the feeling of insecurity and shame living in Dickensian London? Or you're in Los Angeles, living under the conditions portrayed in Blade Runner. Now, those are pretty dramatic, And you can seal yourself away in a suburb and have to deal with it very rarely. But if you live in a big city, you see it every day, and it takes an enormous toll. And it's impossible to prove, but I would suspect that it reverberates throughout our lives individually and collectively. It's painful to have to segregate the stuff and deny it and refuse to ask the questions about what constitutes fairness in society.
That brings me to the conclusion that I'd like to get to. There are a couple of gentlemen that we just interviewed who have been essentially rescuing homeless women in the streets and helping them get through the system just because these women were there living in a bus stop near their home. And they have struggled so much to get through the bureaucracy to get them fundamental care. They're not trained in this way, but it says something about the system that is set up to protect people who fall out of the safety net and what the problems are within it, in the system, that prevent people from getting back into society. What can we do to have a system that is not quite so complicated? Sam Sembaris, maybe you should take the lead on this.
I can't answer the question about why we have made things so difficult for people to get back once they fall out. But they are indeed a very, very steep climb. And it's still the predominant view today. I think, it must go back to this moral perspective of if you are somehow on the street that, you were born of equal wealth, but somehow you've squandered it. And therefore not deserving, you have to earn the benefits. We're in a country where we don't have housing as a basic human right. We don't even have health care as a basic human right or education as affordable. We started the conversation earlier about the structural problems that contribute to homelessness. So the way out of homelessness is, of course, housing quickly. But that still leaves health, education, the livable wage, as another great hill to climb post-housing. There are people that spend a lot of time worried about hazard ratios and how exactly to set the bar at a certain level of difficulty where people will not take advantage. This is sort of the prevailing policy and political view, of both the Democratic and Republican administrations. It's a very different view than a view, let's say, that is enjoyed in Canada or in Europe, where there's a different kind of social contract, where people have a majority belief that says we're going to take care of the most vulnerable among us. When you apply for benefits, we're going to make the process easy. It'll be easy to renew when you apply for disability. We're going to also include a shelter allowance because we know you'll be struggling to pay the rent. This is not written in stone. We don't have to do it this way. There are so many good models of doing it much, much better. And as I don't know if it was Kim or Jim that said earlier, this issue of political will, it's all about a shared decision-making, if you will, about how we can make things much easier for people to get out of homelessness if we want it to be so.
This is Jim Baumol. We create policies that are deliberately designed to demand that ordinary people act like heroes, which is by definition impossible. And those policies are doomed. They can't possibly work. But they're not designed to work. I don't want to sound too cynical, but I would argue that most service systems are designed to conserve their resources, not to spend them. And that involves them in making invidious distinction after invidious distinction, putting the burden on people to prove that they are so colossally desperate that they will do anything to get what you have to offer. And we do that because we think otherwise we're going to be cheated, that we're going to be taken advantage of. And we focus on the very small number of people who have that attitude, instead of understanding that by focusing policy on that very small number of people, we're missing the point.
and we are failing to serve adequately or support adequately the vast majority of people who are in trouble. And this is not an attitude that begins with Ronald Reagan. But Ronald Reagan's presidency and the people particularly that he brought from the State Department of Social Welfare with him to Washington brought that attitude into contemporary social welfare politics.
Kim Hopper, you get the last word.
Two final words, if I may. One is one of the just passing remark that the role of homeless folks in places like Zuccotti Park as part of Occupy Wall Street has really been underappreciated as a sort of durable, reliable source of defiant presence. And what's happened to them in the wake of the raising of the park really deserves documentation. And second, Amartya Sen has raised the level of quality of life with respect to the so-called developing world by asking whether people have a life worth living or a life that they have reason to value. If we applied that same criterion to our own domestic front, I think we would have a hard time avoiding a lot of shame.
I'm going to end it right there at Jim Bummel, Samson Barris, and Kim Hopper. Thank you all so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Samson Barris is a professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University and the founder and executive director of Pathway to Housing. Among his publications are Housing First, The Pathways Model to End Homelessness for People with a Mental Illness and Addiction Manual. James Bummel is professor of the Bryn Mawr College Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research. His publications include Homeless in America and Down and Out in Berkeley, An Overview of a Study of Street People. Kim Hopper is a medical anthropologist and research scientist at the Nathan S. Klein Institute for Psychiatric Research, where he co-directs the Center for the Study of Issues in Public Mental Health. His publications include Reckoning with Homelessness. He's also co-editor of the forthcoming Recovery from Schizophrenia, An International Perspective. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, and Huatemoc Aileman, who produce this show each week, and to Sud Dongre and iConnect, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower, too.